Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And it's getting better, isn't it, folks? I told you it was going to get better. Actually, it won't get better. It's only going to get worse. And we need to start uniting. And the problem is we have so many efforts going on to confuse us and to mislead us and to put us in a position that I can only say will actually help exacerbate our situation or make our situation worse. So with that, let me kind of just dive into, because it's Feedback Friday, and I'm getting lots of great feedback on going through the Constitution, diving into some of this stuff, and so that's great. And I know that there's still some questions, and I've really enjoyed the fact that we had Angeline Marie help in the 14th Amendment. We're going to have her back, and this way we can kind of move forward. See, you know, these things are I don't want to say it's a struggle, but you know, we're swimming here, folks, and you know, sometimes we're either treading water, sometimes we're just trying to, you know, rejuvenate ourselves so that we can get moving again. But the fact is, is that the conditions that we're dealing with are almost all of them are coming from the adversary, or I'll call it, you know, the dark one, the dark side. Now, there are memes out there, and you've probably seen them, where, you know, you see somebody like a king or something that's referring to, you know, the manipulation and so forth. And the one meme I saw recently where, you know, it looked like a monarch was looking over, or some ruler was looking off of a balcony at the people. And there were people that had clearly distinct positions diametrically opposing. And if you think about it, historically, this spans history. As a matter of fact, the left and the right came from ancient politics of France. And the, you know, the concept of division, it spans back into the Roman Empire. I'm not sure if the Egyptian Empire had a lot of division. I think at that point in time, there was so much time left and available that, you know, the people were oppressed, but they were kind of happy, and the pharaohs were gods, and they were kind of happy. And then all of a sudden, they kind of commingled themselves with an elite family that ended up becoming this nation we call Israel. And so, back to the meme, though. So this elite leader standing on the balcony is just going, you know, oh, I got to fight these people to, you know, to basically subdue them. And there's obviously somebody just kind of stating the obvious that you don't have to fight them. All you have to do is get them to fight each other. And that's the secret, folks. This is not just a secret that you just hear today. This has been the tool that has been used which created this lifelong old adage that I don't know how far back it goes. You could probably do the research on it, but I don't think we'll ever really find it. Is united we stand, divided we fall. Because it's just a remake of an older adage, an older version, and what have you. And so, looking at uniting is so hard. Why? I mean, this is like where I'm swimming. Because there's lots of good people. I know really good people that are in the patriotic movement, and it's a ministry for them. And so what Satan does, or what the adversary, what the dark one does, is he basically pollutes people to say, you know what? As long as you're out there helping people, you're doing good. You're doing great. And, you know, you're helping people, you know, come to the truth or what have you. But the reality is you're not helping anybody solve the problem, or you're not leading on solving the problem. You have nothing to do with solving the problem. In other words, you are the problem. You're a part, a big part of the problem, or just a part of the problem. And so there's that old adage that I use, and I don't know where it came from, but if you're not a part of the solution, you are a part of the problem. Because if you're not engaged in actually solving the problem, then what makes you think, you know, you're helping? A lot of times we see people, you know, coming around an accident. Oh, what can I do? What can I do? Get out of here and give us some room so we can, you know, clean up the mess, save these people, what have you. I mean, just imagine 9/11 with the towers falling and all of the people of New York descended. I mean, there wouldn't be enough room for anybody to operate. If everybody just got there to kind of look, observe, and be a part of that point in time, all of the people of New York, they would not have been able to save anybody. They would have just basically, you know, fought themselves in trying to save people. So you have to make sure that you've got something that is actually part of the solution. You have to test this. I don't have the solution. Madison, Jefferson, and as a matter of fact, the divine hand of providence provided the solution. I just happen to challenge you to say, prove me wrong. Prove me that what these guys did. And so, again, I have to defend this. That there's a lot of evil people out there that if they had the opportunity to buy that up so that they could control it and make money off of it, they would. Because intellectual property and copyrights right now is how we're being sold downriver. I just heard Joe Walsh had just sold all of his intellectual property to some bank of audio or what have you. I'm going, why are these old-time artists doing this? I guess maybe he doesn't have any kids to basically, you know, bestow these blessings, these gifts upon them. I don't know. But it sure seems like maybe these rock stars might be at the brink of maybe financial ruin. I don't know. Anyway, getting back to this meme. The elites have understood this for years and years and years and years, and they've been destroying societies with this. How long do you think the British Empire has been around? Do you think that they learned this on their own? And I'm here to tell you, because, I mean, even academia, before the British Empire rose, it had already commingled with the Roman Empire. And 9 times out of 10, when when the new rock or the new house is built, all the parasites scurry, you know, crawl underneath and start thriving under the new rock or under the new the roof of the new house of power. And that's exactly what's happened. It's been happening for millennia. So I'm going to go back to, you know, as conservatives, because last week I really kind of drew upon this point that when you're talking about a conservative, you're not talking about anybody that is actually demanding full compliance of the Constitution. The conservative movement is much like, and it's almost like Christianity, and it is driven by Christianity. So I'm going to challenge you, because nine times when I go down these paths, sometimes people feel hurt, because we're talking about some really personal stuff here. And I'm going to challenge you to prove me wrong, because 9 times out of 10, and I say this, the way you can find out whether an organization or an institution is truly pure on the ideology of what they espouse is if there's money involved, for the most part, because almost 90% of the time, whenever there's money involved, you will find that that organization has become a servant of mammon, because, you know, these people that are working for them, that have been working for them, they're all good people. They got started. Look at the John Birch Society. Look at all of the different organizations that have started off. And as soon as you put a roof over your organization and you start paying bills, you all of a sudden become, a slave to maintaining what you have. You don't want to lay people off. Believe me, I've worked for a business, a corporation that made money. And we provided services, we provided products. And we didn't want to lay people off. I mean, that's human nature. You don't want to cause harm to those people who have been, you know, I don't want to say slaving, but they have been toiling in the factories or in the, you know, in the workplace, in helping. You want to help them out. But you get to a point where all of a sudden your market shifts or what have you, and you have a problem. You now have more people than you can sustain because there's been a cutback, or the supply chain has made it harder for you to maintain the production, and so you've had to trim back so much, and trimming back labor, your people capital, that really hurts. And it is the hardest thing to do. Anybody that has ever gone through or sat across the table from somebody that had to be let go, you have dealt with a very, very difficult, where most people don't go through that. Now, you would say, well, it's harder for that person on the other side. And I will tell you no, because that person goes through it once. And usually that's the best thing that's ever happened to that person. But the person that actually has to be the bad guy, And we've actually seen, you know, there's some movies or what have you, or stories that talk about how this really good person becomes a really bad person because, you know, they didn't want to first do this, but then all of a sudden they started enjoying it. They lose their soul. Back to what we're talking about in this movement. When I look at all of the people that are running around that are subject matter experts now, I'll give you a case in point. Trevor Lawton is a subject matter expert. Here's a guy that is a Rolling Stone. He really gathers no moss, and he's constantly looking, observing, and analyzing communism and its involvement in politics, its involvement in the church, its involvement in our society. So is he a part of the solution? Absolutely he is, because he's a huge advocate for Republic Review. He wrote an article in Epoch Times and basically said, hey, this is one of the steps America has to go through if it's going to save itself. So you have people like that are out there that he may not be working on petitions. He may not be doing the grassroots stuff. But we need somebody looking and doing that. And I'm not here to take anybody away to say you have to focus 100% of your time doing petitions. You have to quit your job. That's not, I don't think we need to do that. I think the Lord will bless us if we just take the time to do the right thing and we contribute somehow. And so there's a lot of people out there that are contributing, but who are they contributing, or what are they contributing to, and, you know, what is the outcome of their contribution? There's way too many folks. There are way too many people out there that are doing this for money. This is why the problem that we're looking at is shedding billions of dollars. I mean, our election process, look how much money is just involved in our election process. You cannot tell me, where does all this money come from? Somebody is toiling, somebody is working. This is money coming from some type of productivity. Now, in some cases, government's printing the money. But when we talk about elections, and that's actually money coming from people and their accounts or corporations. This isn't just money being printed. And it's, as I look at conservatism and as I look at what I said last week, we are really missing it if we're not uniting on the full Constitution, if we're not standing up for the full Constitution. And so we have a lot of people out there that are podcasting, that are, you know, just coming into the fray. And why is this happening? Why is there such an abundance? As a matter of fact, this is biblical. Because we look, and the Bible talks us about false prophets. You know, people claiming to be prophet. I'm not a prophet. I am basically pointing to you that Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, they definitely received the inspiration. Was I inspired to, you know, as I crossed over it, I think it took me several times to finally, you know, get, you know, poked at and prodded, you know, by the divine hand of providence to say, you know, this really is it. So the point is that there are so many people out there. How is this not directly associated to the biblical times? That we have, you know, false prophets and all sorts of people leading us down this path and down this path and down this path. In other words, it has created such a level of confusion. It's like you're swimming in the middle of the ocean and you don't know which is the, you know, which direction is the closest direction towards the shore. You know, you could swim that way and you could be swimming towards the furthest beach to you. You could swim this way, and that is the closest beach to you. You don't know because you can't even see it. And that's, I think, how many people feel. They just don't know. They're overwhelmed. So why I'm not here defending those people that go and watch their, you know, their football, their basketball, or they're you know, completely submerged in entertainment and all of this addictive behavior. As a matter of fact, I have to basically say those people are a huge contributor to the problem. They are a big part of the problem because they're in complete denial of what's going on and why we have to start working together. Now, when I look historically and when I look at how people banded together and united in trying to do something like the Reformation of Christianity with Martin Luther or the 25 Land Barons with the king in getting the Magna Carta. Every time there has been a unification of the people on the truth, and I'm telling you, the Constitution is the truth. Anybody that says otherwise is literally, they're a part of the deception. I ask everybody, and I'm asking you, read the Constitution. Tell me where you see, and read the ratification debates. Show me where there's any evidence that we, you know, we were subjugated by England at this point when the Constitution was written. All of these wild assertions that are out there, folks, you got to do your own research. Because the biggest threat I see... You know, we have a lot of people doing, you know, the convention of states. They're just being misled by a group of people that are making money off of this. It's the same thing with Tactical Civics. It's the same thing with John Birch Society. It's the same thing with all of these different organizations that are making money and trying to get you engaged and make you feel good, but have nothing to do with really solving the problem. And as a matter of fact, they have huge gaps, holes. And what are we going to do about this? How are we going to fix this? They don't know because they're actually creating a solution that will beget a bigger problem. You know, I've seen some, and I just, you know, the General Assemblies and all of these different movements. I'm going, are you kidding me? How is that going to help? So, as I look at evangelical Christianity, I liken it to the conservatism and the conservative movement. It is a false movement. The conservative movement is moving us away from the Constitution. when somebody wants to cherry pick and say this part of the Constitution is more important, you hear me tell you what the most important part is, and everybody scratches their head and say, huh? You know, what does that mean? Article 7 of the Constitution is the most important part because it actually proves what the Constitution is and who the parties are to it. And once you start understanding that and then you read the rest of the Constitution, you read the ratification debates, it becomes very clear that the states are the ones that should be driving this thing. This all proves exactly what Madison and Jefferson were doing and why they did it. So, as I look and I deal with constant, and it's okay, I'm not complaining, because I expect it to get worse, but I honestly see that things are getting better because as people start looking over their shoulder going, what the heck is this over here? What is this? And they actually, come to the table, they start learning and they start participating and testing and verifying the veracity of these assertions that we have. Then, to me, this is how you get full buy-in. I mean, I've had way too many people come to me and they just said, tell me what you want me to do. Tell me what I need to do. Well, I can't tell you how many times I've had people come up and say, how much money can I give you? What is it you need? What can I give you? And some of these people really had a lot of money. And I said, okay, well, I can't tell you what you can give me until you understand what it is we're really doing so that you can determine how much you're willing to share. Or, what resources you possess that can really help. Because who knows? It may not be money. It may be something else. It may be connecting us to the right resources to actually, help get the word out. Sometimes, advertisement or sometimes getting the word out is far more important than, a big paycheck. Especially in an ideological movement like this. And I call it a movement because it has to be your movement. We're not going to succeed. We're going to watch everything go down the drain if we do not create a movement. And this movement has to be in your county. It's not my county. I mean, I've been working in my county and getting other people to get involved in the movement because I have nothing but conservatives where I live. Getting them to become constitutional is like getting a rich man to actually get into heaven. It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to get into heaven. And it's the same thing. I'm looking at all these different parables or all these different, comparisons. And I'm going, this is a great metaphor. These things really speak to what the problem is. They speak to what we need to be doing. So as I leave and move forward, the reason I spent half the show now on this division and, this uprising of what I will call the Ministry of Conservatism, because that's what they are. They're out there healing you so that, you can, be a part of saving your ownership of guns, but have nothing to do with the Constitution, but at least you have your guns. Or at least you don't have to take a vaccination, but you still have to do, the Obamacare accounting and maybe the death panels are around the corner, but at least you don't have to do those vaccinations. Folks, if we're not united on the Constitution, we're just hosed. Now, this really is part three of the grand conspiracy, a macro view of the grand conspiracy. And so when we come back from the break, I will dive back into kind of recover some of the stuff that we covered already and kind of move forward. Because I'm telling you, Britain is a huge part and a huge, I'll say, leader and integral in, everything that we're seeing. And even the Bible speaks about this. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
You know, it's this simple. As soon as somebody starts making a living, or as soon as money gets involved in a process of saving a person, or as soon as money gets involved, it quickly becomes business. And all of a sudden, and I know that there's lots of people that are in the business of religion today, and lots of people in the business of patriotism today, and or in anti-pay. I mean, it's the same thing on the progressive side. The progressives are ideologues that believe that what they're doing is the righteous thing to do, in basically saving you from yourself. And if you really think about it, the Puritans of old, who were really considered ultra-conservative people, I mean, the Puritans are the communists as well. I mean, when we look at compelling people and the concept of compulsion, this is why I tell you the scale of liberty is not about left and right. The scale of liberty is about pure liberty and the degrees that lead you to pure subjugation from white to black with all the shades of gray. See, any shade of gray is a deviation or a move away from pure liberty. So with that, and hopefully that simplifies that so that we can, you know, kind of move into the conspiracy side, right? So we were talking about how Britain saw and seized the opportunity with slavery and used the party system to divide us on this one very particular issue, i.e. slavery. And so just to kind of, you know, that's where we kind of left off. The problem was the duration and our continued growth, why Britain just couldn't come in and take over. The United States kept growing. It kept moving. The more land mass and the greater our concentration, just the harder it would be to come and take over. Now, even though they successfully burnt down D.C. and they could probably do it again, there's more and more people. I mean, it wouldn't take long to marshal and move the militias and the defense force actually back to the coastline and drive them out. So why spend the time in trying to do that type of warfare when they didn't have the means to sustain it? Britain needed such a super fleet. Got to remember, these ships weren't that big. They're not like today. When we went into the Gulf War, there was this thing called the Steel Bridge, and there were two levels of the Steel Bridge. There was literally the Navy and the shipping services that actually connected the world to the Middle East. And it was the airways that connected, you know, the world to the Middle East as well. As we had plane after plane after plane flying back and forth, as well as all of these ships that were available, bringing cargo, bringing troops, or what have you. I'll just say this, when you really look at Desert Storm, that was almost like a world war, even though not all of the world got involved, but we actually had joint services. Did they want to call it a world war? No, because it wasn't that much of a contention.
we overwhelm Saddam Hussein. And as we look at all of our other contentions, we've overwhelmed them. Now, here's an interesting thing. When everybody saw, you know, the advances that we had technologically and everything else, well, that makes it seem like it's so lopsided. So there has to be somebody that's going to come along that will even the scale, because you don't have real control unless you actually have, you know, a fear that, you know, you don't have a dominance of the good guy. The good guy can't dominate. You have to have an equally bad guy that's just as big and just as scary, and AKA China. I mean, here's China coming in. And so let's look at this. There's an irony coming up, but let's look at this, you know, at the macro view. Who has been involved in all of these nations, i.e. China and the rest of the world, over the past century plus? Ah, Britain. Oh, yeah, that's right, Britain. Britain has been the last empire that has actually had its fingers in manipulating, entrenched into the operations. Remember, I told you that, you know, this operations of intelligence is almost everybody working as well as actual operators in the intelligence community in the British intelligence system. So there's no doubt that Britain was working in America with the fabric of our society in the 1800s and government. So they were working both in, you know, amongst our society, our businesses, and those types of things, as well as getting people into government, getting moles or politicians to basically do their bidding. In other words, not just lobbyists, but actually getting people on board with supporting the agenda. And this was before the Civil War. But the American people at that point in time were, and I'm using the words, too good to allow an overt attempt of control. And so they tried to divide us going into the Civil War. And there were many things that they were doing. So as we look at the American Bar Association was founded in the late 1870s. Does that mean that, you know, the British Bar Association came to America in the 1870s? No. They were here and operating and growing as an unofficial organization in the early 1800s, which is one of the reasons why we talked about this on the 13th Amendment. Why that the original 13th Amendment was actually ratified. So there's more than enough symbols, there's more than enough, I should say, indications and evidence that Britain had, you know, even though it was not the British government directly flying under, you know, the flag and or under the commands of the king, these were all covert operations. In other words, these were operations that were being done to set up dominoes, to help set up things for down the road. Now, at this point in time, Britain was not, they did not have enough controls to actually start getting outcomes. But by the time the Civil War came around, they had enough, and they were manipulating enough to where they successfully got us to go down this path, and they convinced the southern states that all the money they needed to basically secede from the Union and maintain their separation was there available for them, which is one of the reasons why there was such great debt on the southern states. So as we kind of look, and like I said, I've already covered this, the Revolutionary War and the second 13th Amendment, which was the amendment that came from Lincoln that would have galvanized slavery, wasn't enough. And as a matter of fact, they looked at that as basically a red herring. They knew that the abolitionists wouldn't even go along with it. There's just no way that the federal government would be able to stem the tide of the abolitionist movement. Now, when you look at, and I invite everybody to go look at some of the failings of Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln is not an Illini by birth. I mean, he came from Kentucky. He was a hardened lawyer from a plethora of failings. I mean, one of the things you'll see is he went into the Army as a captain. He was an educated man and went into the Army, and he got kicked out as a private. As you go through many of the things he had to go through, and you go, wow, this guy, you know, he got kicked around a lot. He had some successes, but none of them were really big to overcome some of the, I'll just say, some of the scuffs and scars and so forth that he had over his lifetime. And so by the time he became president, here he saw the sun rising on the Republic that was basically casting a picture of doom. He saw that he was walking into the presidency where he was going to fail again. And there's no doubt in my mind, he was determined not to fail. And instead of prostrating himself, and I've gone through this with Paul and lots of other people, you know, Lincoln was basically our huge downfall for us. But he was a huge tyrant necessary in ending slavery and basically creating a condition of humility in America. But he was not a person that could actually deal with humility. There's no doubt in my mind he would have been far more harsh and tyrannical than what the radical Republicans tried to do. The radical Republicans tried to actually utilize the Constitution as the proper tool instead of actually having a despot ruling and saying, thou shalt not defy me. So anyway, this is why the post-Civil War and the radical Republicans really gave the British cause to actually take up, you know, an action that they didn't even see. And so it was basically an unexpected, you know, slap in the face when they saw that 14th Amendment Section 4, because Section 4 literally kept, you know, the southern states that came back into the Union from having to pay that debt. Regardless of how legitimate that debt may have been to Britain and to the rest of the world, the law of the land had been galvanized. It was written in stone, and this is what it said. And we already covered this. We just covered this, but I need to say it again. The validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, including debts incurred for payment of the pensions and bounties for services in suppressing the insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned. But neither the United States nor any state shall assume or pay any debt or obligation incurred in aid of insurrection or rebellion against the United States, or any claim for the loss of emancipation of any slave, but all such debt, obligations, and claims shall be held illegal and void. Now, what do you think about reparations now? Do you think reparations are even legal? Any reparations, in other words, folks, what the California is trying to do in paying reparations would actually be a violation of the Constitution. So it doesn't matter whether the obligations of debt or obligations of servitude. It doesn't matter. You cannot, based on our Constitution and based on ex post facto laws and based on bills of attainder and so forth, you can't pass a law that basically after the fact says you shouldn't have done that and you have to pay us. You can't do that. This allows us, and it keeps us from having to constantly revisit the past, and allows us to free ourselves to move forward. But more importantly, this right here, Section 4, was a slap in Britain's face, because all of a sudden Britain realized that it's not going to get a shilling, it's not going to get a pound, it's not going to get any gold or silver out of these states that are coming into the United States. Now, see, the other states, the southern states, they didn't have to come into the Union. So why did they come into the Union? I mean, they could have actually stayed out of the union, right? Did Congress have the power to force them into the union? No. But we ended slavery. And it didn't mean that we ended the Confederacy. See, Lincoln didn't have the authority, nor did Congress have the authority to drag them back in. They had to come in. And so why is it that they actually came into the Union? Prior to this, they were being occupied by the northern states because we were protecting those citizens that had just been freed. This is why they created a Freedmen's Bureau. Now, some of this stuff was unconstitutional, but they were doing what was necessary. And the 14th, and I say necessary because, you know, you don't just go fight a war, free some people, and then leave those people left to die. So there was this moral good intention, but I'm just telling you that they didn't have the constitutional authority to do that. Had they had the amendment that empowered them to do what was necessary to ensure that the freedmen would be able to enjoy all privileges and immunities of every citizen in the United States, other than what was just put into the 14th Amendment, then okay. But when we look at what ended up happening, so this is where we're going to kind of cut off, because I want to actually dive into the Organic Act of 1871. What really happened after the 14th Amendment, it really caught these guys on their heels. Why? Because the 1868 election really helped galvanize and reelected these radical Republicans. The radical Republicans didn't lose their control until 1870. And it's not like there was a huge shift in the politics party-wise. It's who was challenged out and who was replaced and so forth. And all of that money was coming from Britain, and Britain was all in basically getting politically involved in America. And so as they created the 1871 Organic Act, this is where the shenanigans began. And so from that point on, we actually see how the federal government started creating things that they had no authority to do and doing things. I mean, it's not that they weren't doing things that they shouldn't have been doing, but they put it on steroids. And they actually did things that allowed them much later, not constitutionally allowed them, illegally allowed them to aggrandize their, some people call it a crime syndicate, but their tyranny, aggrandize their tyranny. Now, let's go back to Britain. And this is what, you know, we see Britain kind of still controlling and manipulating the world. There was the war with the Ottoman Empire that ended. And then we also had World War One that really, really ended, you know, this control in the Middle East. And so who was the benefactor and who actually had control of Israel after World War One? Well, Britain, of course. Britain actually took over after kicking out or after defeating the Ottoman Empire in 1914. They took over Israel. In 1917, Britain issued the pro-Zionist Balfour Declaration, which called for the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people of Palestine, or in Palestine, because that's what the Ottoman Empire created and called it. Remember? I mean, the Palestinians and that occupation began, you know, from the from Muhammad and those those crusades back then. As a matter of fact, when you actually read, there were points in time where Muhammad actually supported and fought, you know, side by side along with the Jews and the Christians. But it wasn't until later he saw the expediency of declaring that Allah wanted, you know, the whole, you know, that and all people to be subjugated. And these are in the Hadiths. And so there's some really good books, you know, like the Politically Incorrect Truth or something like that about Islam by Robert Spencer. by all means, check out Robert Spencer's work. He dives into this stuff. He actually goes to the Quran and reads it so that you can actually see, and the Hadith, and he reads, you know, what these things, the doctrines that they're reading. And folks, if everybody just read that and actually went and read through the, you know, the Hadiths and the Quran, you'd say, oh my gosh, how are these people, you know, how do we really think that these people could even be U.S. citizens? You know, in what world could they be a U.S. citizen to support the Constitution? Only in a world of make-believe. Because they believe that Allah and theology is their God and is their government. And that the Constitution is not the supreme law of the land. Sharia law and the law of the dictates of Islam and those clerics and those people who claim to be the leaders as they ebb and flow. And that's one of the reasons why Islam over the, you know, from Muhammad on, you know, ebbed and flowed. I mean, there were points in time where it seemed really humane and very nice. And then there's times where it was very despotic and evil. Anyway. So 6 weeks after the British troops concluded the Palestinian campaign, driving out the Ottoman Empire from Jerusalem under the leadership of Field Marshal Allenby, the British took control of Palestine. And actually, see, I have a problem with this. This is out of Wikipedia. They're calling it Palestine when actually they're returning the Jews back to Israel instead of Palestine. So you can start seeing how people are using this specific language, because it was Israel long before it was Palestine. And I know the occupants have changed back and forth, but folks, this was Israel, but they were still calling it Palestine. And under the British military, and the Zionist enterprise was renewed, and in 1920, Britain established its authority under the Mandate for Palestine. That's what they called it, the Mandate for Palestine, which was granted by none other than the League of Nations, this little monster that Woodrow Wilson created with the progressives. So if all of this stuff is happening under the globalist progressives, do you think that this is foreordained for good or foreordained for evil? I look at the gathering of Israel as a necessity that, you know, God has demanded, but I also look at the creation of Israel and that nation as more of Satan's efforts to get all of the Jews back into one box and create a kill box. Okay, now that we have them all located, we don't have to go find them. So when Britain actually started to, you know, consider independence for Israel, that was around 1948, and this is when they permitted the gathering of Israel, or what they created, what I called the kill box, to invite all Jews to go home, make it easier to fulfill the prophecy of their near extinction. Now, I go through how things get manipulated and how we have been manipulated in ways that most people don't even know. As a matter of fact, the gentleman, I think his name's Irving, we'll get into this for Christmas. When we look at what this man did, he was just creating stories. This guy, they were all fictitious stories, but they were, you know, fiction, but they made you feel good. And so people saw this and they go, wow, this, you know, this was really some popular stuff and people were loving it. And they saw this opportunity to create this thing that we now call Christmas. And so this is a direct and successful manipulation of the American people to get us to ignore and walk away and give up on the winter wilding and paganism in America and kind of integrate some of the paganistic portions of that holiday into the Christmas so that everybody could feel good. The use of lore over the history of mankind, you know, the stories, the, you know, the fables, what have you, along with song, transcends the histories of societies so that their use today goes unnoticed. In other words, as we see these things happening, you know, people don't even realize what's happening. This is how we get lured. This is how we, you know, get coerced or get fooled into going down a path that we really do not want to end up on. And lo and behold, we find ourselves there. Irony comes full circle, though. And here's the interesting thing that I want to kind of finish before I get into what's next. Rishi Sunak, who is, and I probably got that wrong, who is the prime minister, he's the British prime minister of the United Kingdom, right? And he's the leader of, quote-unquote, the Conservative Party, not the Labour Party, right, the Communists. He's the conservative side, the good guys, right? He's the first British prime minister who's Asian descent. And when we say Asian, he's actually not Asian. He is Asian, but he's Indian. And when we look at the history of India, you know, what's the number one religion of India? If you say Buddhist or what have you, I think if it's not Islam, it's pretty close. But anyway, as we kind of really start looking at this guy and his resume, he worked with Boris Johnson. Later, he, you know, as the latter chancellor and the ex-chancellor from 20 to 22, and Sunak has been a member of parliament for Richmond, for the area of Richmond, since 2015. So he's kind of new. 2015, for an Asian, this is almost like a Barack Obama-esque thing. Do you see my point? You see how here's somebody that just all of a sudden gets involved in politics, and next thing you know, he's the prime minister? Folks, when you look at Britain, do not think for a minute that the prime minister is really the leader. These guys are puppet heads, just like our president. Our presidents are puppet heads because the party system is controlling them. Our whole government is controlled by a very elaborate, complex, you know, system of party corporations and so forth that have kind of taken over. Which is why we the people need to go back and listen to my. I think it was my Monday series in June, maybe May time frame, where I had like probably 5 to 8 episodes where I talked about if I was going to become president of the United States. I mean, here's my campaign speech. These are my positions. These are the issues and the positions, and this is what America needs for a constitutional president instead of getting somebody that's going to build a wall, a myopic issue, and still turn their back on the rest of the Constitution. So when we come back, and as a matter of fact, I'll just say this. Go do the research on Sunak. Sunak of Southampton. Go do the research on this guy, and you'll realize that how is this not a Barack Obama in Britain as the prime minister? And now look at his role with Israel. Folks, things aren't what they seem, and they are what they seem. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.